Chapter 5, Colonial Society on the Eve of Revolution, 1700 to 1775. The common term 13 original colonies is misleading. Britain ruled 32 colonies in North America by 1775, including Canada, the Floridas, and various Caribbean islands, but only 13 of them unfurled the standard of rebellion. A few of the non-rebels, such as Canada and Jamaica, were larger, wealthier, and more populous than some of the revolting 13. Why, then, did some British colonies eventually strike for their independence, while others did not? Part of the answer is to be found in the distinctive social, economic, and political structure of the 13 Atlantic seaboard colonies, and in the halting, gradual appearance of a recognizably American way of life. Among the distinguishing characteristics that the eventually rebellious settlements shared was lusty population growth. In 1700, they contained fewer than 300,000 souls, about 20,000 of whom were black. By 1775, 2.5 million people inhabited the 13 colonies, of whom about 500,000 were black. White immigrants made up nearly 400,000 of the increased number, and black forced immigrants accounted for almost as many again. But most of the spurt stemmed from the remarkable natural fertility of all Americans, white and black. To the amazement and dismay of Europeans, the colonists were doubling their numbers every 25 years. Unfriendly Dr. Samuel Johnson, back in England, growled that the Americans were multiplying like their own rattlesnakes. They were also a youthful people, whose average age in 1775 was about 16. This population boom had political consequences. In 1700, there were 20 English subjects for each American colonist. By 1775, the English advantage in numbers had fallen to 3-1, setting the stage for a momentous shift in the balance of power between the colonies and Britain. The bulk of the population was cooped up east of the Alleghenies, although by 1775 a vanguard of pioneers had trickled into the stump-studded clearings of Tennessee and Kentucky. The most populous colonies in 1775 were Virginia, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Maryland, in that order. Only four communities could properly be called cities. Philadelphia, including suburbs, was first with about 34,000 residents, trailed by New York, Boston, and Charleston. About 90% of the people lived in rural areas. Colonial America was a melting pot and had been from the outset. The population, although basically English in stock and language, was picturesquely mottled with numerous foreign groups. Heavy-accented Germans constituted about 6% of the total population, or 150,000 by 1775. Fleeing religious persecution, economic oppression, and the ravages of war, they had flocked to America in the early 1700s and had settled chiefly in Pennsylvania. They belonged to several different Protestant sects, primarily Lutheran, and thus further enhanced the religious diversity of the colony. Known popularly but erroneously as the Pennsylvania Dutch, a corruption of the German word Deutsch for German, they totaled about one-third of the colony's population. In parts of Philadelphia, the street signs were painted in both German and English. These German newcomers moved into the backcountry of Pennsylvania, where their splendid stone barns gave, and still give, mute evidence of industry and prosperity. Not having been brought up English, they had no deep-rooted loyalty to the British crown, and they clung tenaciously to their German language and customs. The Scots-Irish, who in 1775 numbered around 175,000, or 7% of the population, were an important non-English group, although they spoke English. They were not Irish at all, but turbulent Scots lowlanders. Over many decades, they had been transplanted to Northern Ireland, where they had not prospered. The Irish Catholics already there, hating Scottish Presbyterianism, resented the intruders, and still do. The source of many of the modern-day troubles in the Northern Ireland province of Ulster. The economic life of the Scots-Irish was severely hampered, especially when the English government placed burdensome restrictions on their production of linens and woolens. Early in the 1700s, tens of thousands of embittered Scots-Irish finally abandoned Ireland and came to America, chiefly to tolerant and deep-soiled Pennsylvania. Finding the best acres already taken by Germans and Quakers, they pushed out onto the frontier, making them among the first settlers of the American West. There, many of them illegally but defiantly squatted on unoccupied lands and quarreled with both Indian and white owners. When the westward-flowing Scots-Irish tide lapped up against the Allegheny Barrier, it was deflected southward into the backcountry of Maryland, down Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, and into the western Carolinas. Their often rickety settlements bore the marks of Scots-Irish restlessness. Whereas their German neighbors typically erected sturdy homes and cleared their fields meticulously, the Scots-Irish satisfied themselves with floorless, flimsy log cabins. As befitted an uprooted, questing people, they chopped down trees, planted crops between the stumps, exhausted the soil swiftly, and moved on. Already experienced colonizers and agitators in Ireland, the Scots-Irish proved to be superb frontiersmen, though their readiness to visit violence on the Indians repeatedly inflamed the western districts. By the mid-18th century, a chain of Scots-Irish settlements lay scattered along the Great Wagon Road, which hugged the eastern Appalachian foothills from Pennsylvania to Georgia. It was said, somewhat unfairly, that the Scots-Irish kept the Sabbath, and all else they could lay their hands on. Pugnacious, lawless, and individualistic, they brought with them the Scottish secrets of whiskey distilling and dotted the Appalachian hills and hollows with their stills. They cherished no love for the British government that had uprooted them and still lorded over them, or for any other government, it seemed. They led the armed march of the Paxton Boys on Philadelphia in 1764, protesting the Quaker oligarchy's lenient policy toward the Indians, and a few years later spearheaded the Regulator Movement in North Carolina, a small but nasty insurrection against Eastern domination of the colony's affairs. Many of these hotheads, including the young Andrew Jackson, eventually joined the embattled American revolutionaries. All told, about a dozen future presidents were of Scots-Irish descent. Approximately 5% of the multicolored colonial population consisted of other European groups. These embraced French Huguenots, Welsh, Dutch, Swedes, Jews, Irish, Swiss, and Scots Highlanders, as distinguished from the Scots-Irish. Except for the Scots Highlanders, such hodgepodge elements left little loyalty to the British crown. By far the largest single non-English group was African, accounting for nearly 20% of the colonial population in 1775, and heavily concentrated in the south. The population of the 13 colonies, though mainly Anglo-Saxon, was perhaps the most mixed to be found anywhere in the world. The South, holding about 90% of the slaves, already displayed its historic black and white racial composition. New England, mostly staked out by the original Puritan migrants, showed the least ethnic diversity. The middle colonies, especially Pennsylvania, received the bulk of later white immigrants and boasted an astonishing variety of peoples. Outside of New England, about one-half the population was non-English in 1775. Of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence in 1776, 18 were non-English, and 8 had not been born in the colonies. As these various immigrant groups mingled and intermarried, they laid the foundations for a new, multicultural American national identity, unlike anything known in Europe. The French settler, Michel Guillaume Jean de Crevecoeur, saw in America in the 1770s a strange mixture of blood, which you will find in no other country, and he posed his classic question, what then is the American, this new man? Nor were white colonists alone in creating new societies out of diverse ethnic groups. The African slave trade long had mixed peoples from many different tribal backgrounds, giving birth to an African-American community far more variegated in its cultural origins than anything to be found in Africa itself. Similarly, in the New England praying towns, where Indians were gathered to be Christianized, and in Great Lakes villages such as Detroit, home to dozens of different displaced indigenous peoples, polyglot Native American communities emerged, blurring the boundaries of individual tribal identities. Slavery exploded in the North American colonies during the 18th century. Life for slaves was everywhere terrible, though not everywhere the same. In the deepest South, slave life was especially severe. The climate was hostile to health, and the labor was life-draining. The widely scattered South Carolina rice and indigo plantations were lonely hells on earth, where gangs of mostly male Africans toiled and perished. Only fresh imports could sustain the slave population under these loathsome conditions. Blacks in the tobacco-growing Chesapeake region had a somewhat easier lot. Tobacco was a less physically demanding crop than those of the deeper South, and tobacco plantations were larger and closer to one another than rice plantations. The size and proximity of these tobacco farms permitted the slaves more frequent contact with friends and relatives. By about 1720, the proportion of females in the Chesapeake slave population had begun to rise, making family life possible. The captive black population of the Chesapeake area soon began to grow through its own fertility, making it one of the few slave societies in history to perpetuate itself by its own natural reproduction. From this point forward, slave imports to the Chesapeake from the West Indies and Africa dropped significantly, while the deeper South remained heavily dependent on the continuing transatlantic slave trade. Slavery in the colonies north of the Chesapeake, though smaller in overall magnitude, grew as well. By the eve of the Revolutionary War, the northern colonies counted some 48,000 slaves. Many of these men, women, and children toiled in cities, often for artisans. But many labored, like their southern brethren, in agricultural gangs in New York's Hudson River Valley or in northern New Jersey. As the ratio of native-born blacks to imported Africans grew during the 1700s, a distinctive African-American culture began to flourish throughout the colonies that was a mixture of African and American elements of speech, religion, and folkways. On the sea islands off South Carolina's coast, blacks evolved a unique language, Gullah, probably a corruption of Angola, the African region from which many of them had come, that blended English with several African languages, including Yoruba, Igbo, and Hausa. Through it, many African words have passed into American speech, such as goober, or peanut, gumbo, okra, and voodoo, witchcraft. The ring shout, a West African religious dance performed by shuffling in a circle while answering a preacher's shouts, was brought to colonial America by Africans and eventually contributed to the development of jazz. The banjo and the bongo drum were other African contributions to American culture. Enslaved Africans also helped mightily to build the country with their labor. A few became skilled artisans, carpenters, bricklayers, and tanners, but chiefly they performed the sweaty toil of clearing swamps, grubbing out trees, and doing other menial tasks. Condemned to life under the lash, slaves naturally pined for freedom. The New York slave revolt that erupted in 1712 cost the lives of 9 whites and caused the execution of 21 blacks, some of them burned at the stake over a slow fire. A South Carolina slave revolt erupted in 1739 when more than 50 resentful blacks along the Stono River tried to march to Spanish Florida, only to be stopped by the local militia. But in the end, enslaved Africans in the South proved to be a more tightly controlled labor force than the white indentured servants they gradually replaced. No slave uprising in American history matched the scale of Bacon's Rebellion in 1676. In comparison to contemporary Europe, 18th century America seemed like a shining land of equality and opportunity, with the notorious exception of slavery. No titled nobility dominated society from on high, and no pauperized underclass threatened it from below. Most white Americans, and even a handful of free blacks, were small farmers. Clad in buckskin breeches, they owned modest holdings and tilled them with their own hands and horses. The cities contained a small class of skilled artisans with their well-greased leather aprons, as well as shopkeepers, tradespeople, and some unskilled day laborers. The most remarkable feature of the social ladder was its openness. An ambitious colonist, even a former indentured servant, could rise from a lower rung to a higher one, a rare step in Old England. Yet in contrast with 17th century America, colonial society on the eve of the Revolution was beginning to show signs of stratification and barriers to mobility that raised worries about the Europeanization of America. The gods of war contributed to these developments. The armed conflicts of the 1690s and early 1700s had allowed a number of merchant princes in the New England and Middle colonies to lay the foundations of their fortunes with profits made as military suppliers. Roosting regally atop the social ladder, these elites now feathered their nests more finely, sporting imported clothing and dining at tables laid with English china and gleaming silverware. Prominent individuals came to be seated in churches and schools according to their social rank. By mid-century, the richest 10% of Bostonians and Philadelphians owned nearly two-thirds of the taxable wealth in their cities. The plague of war also created a class of widows and orphans who became dependent for their survival on charity. Both Philadelphia and New York built almshouses in the 1730s to care for the destitute, yet the numbers of poor people remained tiny compared to the numbers in England, where about a third of the population lived in impoverished squalor. In the New England countryside, the descendants of the original settlers faced more limited prospects than had their pioneering forebears. As the supply of unclaimed soil dwindled and families grew, existing landholdings were repeatedly subdivided. The average size of farms shrank drastically. Younger sons, as well as daughters, were forced to hire out as wage laborers, or eventually to seek virgin tracts of land beyond the Alleghenies. By 1750, Boston contained a large number of homeless poor, who were supported by public charity and compelled to wear a large red P on their clothing. In the South, the power of the great planters continued to be bolstered by their disproportionate ownership of slaves. The riches created by the growing slave population in the 18th century were not distributed evenly among the whites. Wealth was concentrated in the hands of the largest slave owners, widening the gap between the prosperous gentry and the poor whites, who were more and more likely to become tenant farmers. In all the colonies, the ranks of the lower classes were further swelled by the continuing stream of indentured servants, many of whom ultimately achieved prosperity and prestige. Two became signers of the Declaration of Independence. Far less fortunate than the voluntary indentured servants were the paupers and convicts involuntarily shipped to America. Altogether, about 50,000 jailbirds were dumped on the colonies by the London authorities. This riffraff crowd, including robbers, rapists, and murderers, was generally sullen and undesirable and not bubbling over with goodwill for the king's government. But many convicts were the unfortunate victims of circumstances and of a viciously unfair English penal code that included about 200 capital crimes. Some of the deportees, in fact, came to be highly respectable citizens. Least fortunate of all, of course, were the enslaved blacks. They enjoyed no equality with whites and dared not even dream of ascending or even approaching the ladder of opportunity. Oppressed and downtrodden, the slaves were America's closest approximation to Europe's volatile lower classes, and fears of black rebellion plagued the white colonists. Some colonial legislatures, notably South Carolina's in 1760, sensed the dangers present in a heavy concentration of resentful slaves and attempted to restrict or halt their importation. But the British authorities, seeking to preserve the supply of cheap labor for the colonies, especially the West Indies sugar plantations, repeatedly vetoed all efforts to stem the transatlantic traffic in slaves. Many North American colonists condemned these vetoes as morally callous, although New England slave traders benefited handsomely from the British policy. The cruel complexity of the slavery issue was further revealed when Thomas Jefferson, himself a slaveholder, assailed the British vetoes in an early draft of the Declaration of Independence, but was forced to withdraw the proposed clause by a torrent of protest from Southern slave masters. Most honored of the professions was the Christian ministry. In 1775, the clergy wielded less influence than in the early days of Massachusetts, when piety had burned more warmly, but they still occupied a position of high prestige. Most physicians, on the other hand, were poorly trained and not highly esteemed. Not until 1765 was the first medical school established, although European centers attracted some students. Aspiring young doctors served for a while as apprentices to older practitioners and were then turned loose on their victims. Bleeding was a favorite and frequently fatal remedy. When the physician was not available, a barber was often summoned. Epidemics were a constant nightmare. Especially dreaded was smallpox, which affected one out of five persons, including the heavily pockmarked George Washington. A crude form of inoculation was introduced in 1721, despite the objections of many physicians and some of the clergy who opposed tampering with the will of God. Powdered dried toad was a favorite prescription for smallpox. Diphtheria was also a deadly killer, especially of young people. One epidemic in the 1730s took the lives of thousands. This grim reminder of their mortality may have helped to prepare many colonists in their hearts and minds for the religious revival that was soon to sweep them up. At first, the law profession was not favorably regarded. In this pioneering society, which required much honest manual labor, the parties to a dispute often presented their own cases in court. Lawyers were commonly regarded as noisy windbags or troublemaking rogues. An early Connecticut law classed them with drunkards and brothel keepers. When future President John Adams was a young law student, the father of his wife-to-be frowned upon him as a suitor because of his chosen profession. Agriculture was the leading industry, involving about 90% of the people. Tobacco continued to be the staple crop in Maryland and Virginia, though wheat cultivation also spread through the Chesapeake, often on lands depleted by the overgrowth of tobacco. The fertile middle bread colonies produced large quantities of grain, and by 1759, New York alone was exporting 80,000 barrels of flour a year. Seemingly, the farmer had only to tickle the soil with a hoe, and it would laugh with a harvest. Overall, Americans probably enjoyed a higher standard of living than the masses of any country in history up to that time. Fishing, including whaling, though ranking far below agriculture, was rewarding. Pursued in all the American colonies, this harvesting of the sea was a major industry in New England, which exported smelly shiploads of dried cod to the Catholic countries of Europe. The fishing fleet also stimulated shipbuilding and served as a nursery for the seamen who manned the Navy and Merchant Marine. A bustling commerce, both coastwise and overseas, enriched all the colonies, especially the New England group, New York, and Pennsylvania. Commercial ventures and land speculation, in the absence of later get-rich-quick schemes, were the surest avenues to speedy wealth. Yankee seamen were famous in many climes, not only as skilled mariners, but also as tight-fisted traders. They provisioned the Caribbean sugar islands with food and forest products. They also hauled Spanish and Portuguese gold, wine, and oranges to London to be exchanged for industrial goods, which were then sold for a juicy profit in America. The so-called triangular trade was infamously profitable, though small in relation to total colonial commerce. A skipper, for example, would leave a New England port with a cargo of rum and sail to the Gold Coast of Africa. Bartering the fiery liquor with African chiefs for captured African slaves, he would proceed to the West Indies with his sobbing and suffocating cargo sardined below deck. There he would exchange the survivors for molasses, which he would then carry to New England, where it would be distilled into rum. He would then repeat the trip, making a handsome profit on each leg of the triangle. Manufacturing in the colonies was of only secondary importance, although there was a surprising variety of small enterprises. As a rule, workers could get ahead faster in soil-rich America by tilling the land. Huge quantities of kill-devil rum were distilled in Rhode Island and Massachusetts, and even some of the elect of the Lord developed an over-fondness for it. Handsome beaver hats were manufactured in quantity, despite British restrictions. Smoking iron forges, including Pennsylvania's Valley Forge, likewise dotted the land, and in fact were more numerous in 1775, though generally smaller, than those of England. In addition, household manufacturing, including spinning and weaving by women, added up to an impressive output. As in all pioneering countries, strong-backed laborers and skilled craftspeople were scarce and highly prized. In early Virginia, a carpenter who had committed a murder was freed because his woodworking skills were needed. Lumbering was perhaps the most important single manufacturing activity. Countless cartloads of fresh-felled timber were consumed by shipbuilders, at first chiefly in New England and then elsewhere in the colonies. By 1770, about 400 vessels of assorted sizes were splashing down the ways each year, and about one-third of the British merchant marine was American-built. Colonial naval stores, such as tar, pitch, rosin, and turpentine, were highly valued, for Britain was anxious to gain and retain a mastery of the seas. London offered generous bounties to stimulate production of these items. Otherwise, Britain would have had to turn to the uncertain and possibly hostile Baltic areas. Towering trees, ideal as masts for His Majesty's Navy, were marked with the king's broad arrow for future use. The luckless colonist who was caught cutting down this reserve timber was subject to a fine. Even though there were countless unreserved trees and the blazed ones were being saved for the common defense, this shackle on free enterprise engendered considerable bitterness. Americans held an important flank of a thriving, many-sided Atlantic economy by the dawn of the 18th century. Yet strains appeared in this complex network as early as the 1730s. While the fast-breeding Americans demanded more and more British products, the slow-growing British population early reached the saturation point for absorbing imports from America. This trade imbalance raised a question. How could the colonists sell the goods to make the money to buy what they wanted in Britain? The answer was obvious, by seeking foreign or non-British markets. By the eve of the Revolution, the bulk of Chesapeake tobacco was filling pipes in France and in other European countries, though it passed through the hands of British re-exporters who took a slice of the profits for themselves. More important was the trade with the West Indies, especially the French islands. West Indian purchases of North American timber and foodstuffs provided the crucial cash for the colonists to continue to make their own purchases from Britain. But in 1733, bowing to pressure from influential British West Indian planters, Parliament passed the Molasses Act, aimed at squelching North American trade with the French West Indies. If successful, the scheme would have struck a crippling blow to American international trade and to colonists' standard of living. American merchants responded to the act by bribing and smuggling their way around the law. Thus was foreshadowed the impending imperial crisis, when headstrong Americans would revolt rather than submit to the dictates of the far-off Parliament, apparently bent on destroying their very livelihood. All sprawling and sparsely populated pioneer communities are cursed with oppressive problems of transportation. America, with a scarcity of both money and workers, was no exception. Not until the 1700s did roads connect even the major cities, and these dirt thoroughfares were treacherously deficient. A wayfarer could have rumbled along more rapidly over the Roman highways in the days of Julius Caesar, nearly 2,000 years earlier. It took young Benjamin Franklin 9 long, rain-drenched days in 1720 to journey from Boston to Philadelphia, traveling by sailing sloop, rowboat, and foot. News of the Declaration of Independence in 1776 reached Charleston from Philadelphia 29 days after the 4th of July. Roads were often clouds of dust in the summer and quagmires of mud in the winter. Stagecoach travelers braved such additional dangers as tree-strewn roads, rickety bridges, carriage overturns, and runaway horses. A traveler venturesome enough to journey from Philadelphia to New York, for example, would not think it amiss to make a will and pray with the family before departing. Where man-made roads were wretched, heavy reliance was placed on God-grooved waterways. Population tended to cluster along the banks of navigable rivers. There was also much coastwise traffic, and all that was slow and undependable, it was relatively cheap and pleasant, at least in fair weather. Taverns sprang up along the main routes of travel, as well as in the cities. Their attractions customarily included such amusements as bowling alleys, pool tables, bars, and gambling equipment. Before a cheerful, roaring log fire, all social classes would mingle, including the village loafers and drunks. The tavern was yet another cradle of democracy. Gossips also gathered at the taverns, which were clearing houses of information, misinformation, and rumor, frequently stimulated by alcoholic refreshment and impassioned political talk. A successful politician, like the wire-pulling Samuel Adams, was often a man who had a large alehouse fraternity in places like Boston's Green Dragon Tavern. Taverns were important in crystallizing public opinion and proved to be hotbeds of agitation as the revolutionary movement gathered momentum. An intercolonial postal system was established by the mid-1700s, although private couriers remained. Some mail was handled on credit. Service was slow and infrequent, and secrecy was problematic. Mail carriers, serving long routes, would sometimes pass the time by reading the letters entrusted to their care. Two established or tax-supported churches were conspicuous in 1775, the Anglican and the Congregational. A considerable segment of the population, surprisingly enough, did not worship in any church, and in those colonies that maintained an established religion, only a minority of the people belonged to it. The Church of England, whose members were commonly called Anglicans, became the official faith in Georgia, North and South Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, and a part of New York. Established also in England, it served in America as a major prop of kingly authority. British officials naturally made vigorous attempts to impose it on additional colonies, but they ran into a stone wall of opposition. In America, the Anglican Church fell distressingly short of its promise. Secure and self-satisfied, like its parent in England, it clung to a faith that was less fierce and more worldly than the religion of puritanical New England. Sermons were shorter, hell was less scorching, and amusements, like Virginia fox hunting, were less scorned. So dismal was the reputation of the Anglican clergy in 17th century Virginia that the College of William and Mary was founded in 1693 to train a better class of clerics. The influential Congregational Church, which had grown out of the Puritan Church, was formally established in all the New England colonies, except independent-minded Rhode Island. At first, Massachusetts taxed all residents to support Congregationalism, but later relented and exempted members of other well-known denominations. Presbyterians, though closely associated with Congregationalism, was never made official in any colonies. Ministers of the gospel, turning from the Bible to this sinful world, increasingly grappled with burning political issues. As the early rumblings of revolution against the British crown could be heard, sedition flowed freely from pulpits. Presbyterianism, Congregationalism, and rebellion became a neo-trinity. Many leading Anglican clergymen, aware of which side their tax-provided bread was buttered on, naturally supported their king. Anglicans in the New World were seriously handicapped by not having a resident bishop, whose presence would be convenient for the ordination of young ministers. American students of Anglican theology had to travel to England to be ordained. On the eve of the Revolution, there was serious talk of creating an American bishopric, but the scheme was violently opposed by many non-Anglicans who feared a tightening of the royal reins. This controversy poured holy oil on the smoldering fires of rebellion. Religious toleration had indeed made enormous strides in America, at least when compared with its halting steps abroad. Roman Catholics were still generally discriminated against, as in England, even in office holding. But there were fewer Catholics in America, and hence the anti-papist laws were less severe and less strictly enforced. In general, people could worship, or not worship, as they pleased. In all the colonial churches, religion was less fervid in the early 18th century than it had been a century earlier, when the colonies were first planted. The Puritan churches in particular sagged under the weight of two burdens, their elaborate theological doctrines and their compromising efforts to liberalize membership requirements. Churchgoers increasingly complained about the dead dogs who droned out tedious, overly erudite sermons from Puritan pulpits. Some ministers, on the other hand, worried that many of their parishioners had gone soft and that their souls were no longer kindled by the hellfire of Orthodox Calvinism. Liberal ideas began to challenge the old-time religion. Some worshippers now proclaimed that human beings were not necessarily predestined to damnation and might save themselves by leading a life of good works. Most threatening to the Calvinist doctrine of predestination was Arminianism, named after the Dutch theologian Jacobus Arminius, who preached that individual free will, not divine decree, determined a person's eternal fate, and that all humans, not just the elect, could be saved if they freely accepted God's grace. Pressured by these heresies, a few churches grudgingly conceded that spiritual conversion was not necessary for church membership. T. together these twin trends toward clerical intellectualism and lay liberalism were sapping doctrinal rigor from many denominations, though Americans remained a remarkably religious people. The stage was thus set for a rousing religious revival. Known as the Great Awakening, it exploded in the 1730s and 1740s and swept through the colonies like a fire through prairie grass. The Awakening was first ignited in Northampton, Massachusetts, by a tall, delicate, and intellectual pastor, Jonathan Edwards. Perhaps the deepest theological mind ever nurtured in America, Edwards proclaimed with burning righteousness the folly of believing in salvation through good works, and affirmed the need for complete dependence on God's grace. Warming to his subject, he painted in lurid detail the landscape of hell and the eternal torments of the damned. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God was the title of one of his most famous sermons. He believed that hell was paved with the skulls of unbaptized children. Edwards' preaching style was learned and closely reasoned, but his stark doctrines sparked a warmly sympathetic reaction among his parishioners in 1734. 4 years later, the itinerant English parson George Whitefield loosed a different style of evangelical preaching on America and touched off a conflagration of religious ardor that revolutionized the spiritual life of the colonies. A former alehouse attendant, Whitefield was an orator of rare gifts. His magnificent voice boomed sonorously over thousands of enthralled listeners in an open field. One of England's greatest actors of the day commented enviously that Whitefield could make audiences weep merely by pronouncing the word Mesopotamia, and then he would give 100 guineas if I could only say, "Oh," like Mr. Whitefield. Triumphantly touring the colonies, Whitefield trumpeted his message of human helplessness and divine omnipotence. His eloquence reduced Jonathan Edwards to tears, and even caused the skeptical and thrifty Benjamin Franklin to empty his pockets into the collection plate. During these roaring revival meetings, countless sinners professed conversion, and hundreds of the saved groaned, shrieked, or rolled in the snow from religious excitation. Whitefield soon inspired American imitators. Taking up his electrifying new style of preaching, they heaped abuse on sinners and shook enormous audiences with emotional appeals. One preacher cackled hideously in the face of hapless wrongdoers. Another, naked to the waist, leapt frantically about in the light of flickering torches. Orthodox clergymen, known as old lights, were deeply skeptical of the emotionalism and the theatrical antics of the revivalists. New lights, on the other hand, defended the Awakening for its role in revitalizing American religion. Congregationalists and Presbyterians split over this issue, and many of the believers in religious conversion went over to the Baptists, Methodists, and other sects more prepared to make room for emotion in religion. The Awakening left many lasting effects. Its emphasis on direct, emotive spirituality seriously undermined the older clergy, whose authority had derived from their education and erudition. The schisms it set off in many denominations greatly increased the number and the competitiveness of American churches. It encouraged a fresh wave of missionary work among the Indians and even among black slaves, many of whom also attended the mass open-air revivals. It led to the founding of New Light centers of higher learning such as Princeton, Brown, Rutgers, and Dartmouth. Perhaps most significant, the Great Awakening was the first spontaneous mass movement of the American people. It tended to break down sectional boundaries as well as denominational lines and contributed to the growing sense that Americans were a single people, united by a common history and shared experiences. A time-honored English idea regarded education as a blessing reserved for the aristocratic few, not for the unwashed many. Education should be for leadership, not citizenship, and primarily for males. Only slowly and painfully did the colonists break the chains of these ancient restrictions. Puritan New England, largely for religious reasons, was more zealously interested in education than any other section. Dominated by the Congregational Church, it stressed the need for Bible reading by the individual worshiper. The primary goal of the clergy was to make good Christians rather than good citizens. A more secular approach was evident late in the 18th century, when some children were warned in the following verse: "He who never learns his ABC, forever will a blockhead be. But he who learns his letters fair,
shall have a coach to take the air. Education, principally for boys, flourished almost from the outset in New England. This densely populated region boasted an impressive number of graduates from the English universities, especially Cambridge, the intellectual center of England's Puritanism. New Englanders, at a relatively early date, established primary and secondary schools, which varied widely in the quality of instruction and in the length of time that their doors remained open each year. Back-straining farm labor drained much of the youth's time and energy. Fairly adequate elementary schools were also hammering knowledge into the heads of reluctant scholars in the middle colonies and in the South. Some of these institutions were tax-supported, others were privately operated. The South, with its white and black population diffused over wide areas, was severely handicapped by geography in attempting to establish an effective school system. Wealthy families leaned heavily on private tutors. The general atmosphere in the colonial schools and colleges continued grim and gloomy. Most of the emphasis was placed on religion and on the classical languages, Latin and Greek. The focus was not on experiment and reason, but on doctrine and dogma. The age was one of orthodoxy, and independence of thinking was discouraged. Discipline was quite severe, with many a mischievous child being sadistically birched with a switch cut from a birch tree. Sometimes punishment was inflicted by indentured servant teachers who could themselves be whipped for their failures as workers, and who therefore were not inclined to spare the rod. College education, at least at first in New England, was geared toward preparing men for the ministry. After all, churches would wither if a new crop of ministers was not adequately trained to lead the region's spiritual flocks. Annoyed by this exclusively religious emphasis, many well-to-do families, especially in the South, sent their boys abroad to acquire a real, meaning a refined and philosophical education in elite English institutions. For purposes of convenience and economy, 9 local colleges were established during the colonial era. Student enrollments were small, numbering about 200 boys at the most, and at one time a few lads as young as 11 were admitted to Harvard. Instruction was poor by present-day standards. The curriculum was still heavily loaded with theology and the dead languages, although by 1750 there was a distinct trend toward live languages and other modern subjects. A significant contribution was made by Benjamin Franklin. He had never attended college, but played a major role in launching what became the University of Pennsylvania, the first American college free from denominational control. When it came to art and culture, colonial Americans were still enthralled to European tastes, especially British. The simplicity of pioneering life had not yet bred many homespun patrons of the arts. One aspiring painter, John Trumbull of Connecticut, was discouraged in his youth by his father's chilling remark, "Connecticut is not Athens." Like so many of his talented artistic contemporaries, Trumbull was forced to travel to London to pursue his ambitions. Charles Wilson Peale, best known for his portraits of George Washington, ran a museum, stuffed birds, and practiced dentistry. Gifted Benjamin West and precocious John Singleton Copley succeeded in their ambitions to become famous painters. But like Trumbull, they had to go to England to complete their training. Only abroad could they find subjects who had the leisure to sit for their portraits and the money to pay handsomely for them. Copley was regarded as a loyalist during the Revolutionary War, and West, a close friend of George III, an official court painter, was buried in London's St. Paul's Cathedral. Architecture was largely imported from the Old World and modified to meet the peculiar climatic and religious conditions of the New World. Even the lowly log cabin was apparently borrowed from Sweden. The red brick Georgian style, so common in the pre-revolutionary decades, was introduced around 1720 and is best exemplified by the beauty of now restored Williamsburg, Virginia. Colonial literature, like art, was generally undistinguished, and for many of the same reasons. One noteworthy exception was the precocious poet Phyllis Wheatley, an enslaved girl brought to Boston at age 8 and never formally educated. Taken to England when 20 years of age, she published a book of verse and subsequently wrote other polished poems that reveal the influence of Alexander Pope. Her verse compares favorably with the best of the poetry poor colonial period, but the remarkable fact is that she could overcome her severely disadvantaged background and write any poetry at all. Versatile Benjamin Franklin, often called the first civilized American, also shone as a literary light. Although his autobiography is now a classic, he was best known to his contemporaries for Poor Richard's Almanac, which he edited from 1732 to 1758. This famous publication, containing many pithy sayings culled from the thinkers of the ages, emphasized such homespun virtues as thrift, industry, morality, and common sense. Examples are, "What maintains one vice would bring up two children? Plow deep while sluggards sleep. Honesty is the best policy." And "Fish and visitors stink in 3 days." Poor Richard's was well known in Europe and was more widely read in America than anything except the Bible. Dispensing witty advice to old and young alike, Franklin had an incalculable influence in shaping the American character. Science, rising above the shackles of superstition, was making some progress, though lagging behind that of the old world. A few botanists, mathematicians, and astronomers had won some repute, but Benjamin Franklin was perhaps the only first-ranked scientist produced in the American colonies. Franklin's spectacular but dangerous experiments, including the famous kite-flying episode proving that lightning was a form of electricity, won him numerous honors in Europe. But his mind also had a practical turn. Among his numerous inventions were bifocal spectacles and the highly efficient Franklin stove. His lightning rod, perhaps not surprisingly, was condemned by some stodgy clergymen who felt it was presuming on God by attempting to control the artillery of the heavens. Stump-grubbing Americans were generally too poor to buy quantities of books and too busy to read them. A South Carolina merchant in 1744 advertised the arrival of a shipment of printed books, pictures, maps, and pickles. A few private libraries of fair size could be found, especially among the clergy. The Byrd family of Virginia enjoyed perhaps the largest collection in the colonies, consisting of about 4,000 volumes. Bustling Benjamin Franklin established in Philadelphia the first privately supported circulating library in America, and by 1776 there were about 50 public libraries and collections supported by subscription. Hand-operated printing presses cranked out pamphlets, leaflets, and journals. On the eve of the Revolution, there were about 40 colonial newspapers, chiefly weeklies that consisted of a single large sheet folded once. Columns ran heavily to somber essays, frequently signed with such pseudonyms as Cicero, Philosophicus, and Pro Bono Publico, for the public good. The news often lagged many weeks behind the event, especially in the case of overseas happenings, in which the colonists were deeply interested. Newspapers proved to be a powerful agency for airing colonial grievances and rallying opposition to British control. A celebrated legal case in 1734 to 1735 involved John Peter Zenger, a newspaper printer. Significantly, the Zenger trial arose in New York, reflecting the tumultuous give-and-take of politics in the Middle Colonies, where so many different ethnic groups jostled against one another. Zenger's newspaper had assailed the corrupt royal governor. Charged with seditious libel, the accused was hauled into court, where he was defended by a former indentured servant, now a distinguished Philadelphia lawyer, Alexander Hamilton. Zenger argued that he had printed the truth, but the bewigged royal chief justice instructed the jury not to consider the truth or falsity of Zenger's statements. The mere fact of printing, irrespective of the truth, was enough to convict. Hamilton countered that the very liberty of both exposing and opposing arbitrary power was at stake. Swayed by his eloquence, the jurors defied the bewigged judges and daringly returned a verdict of not guilty. Cheers burst from the spectators. The Zenger decision was a banner achievement for freedom of the press and for the health of democracy. It pointed the way to the kind of open public discussion required by the diverse society that colonial New York already was and that all America was to become. Although contrary to existing law and not immediately accepted by other judges and juries, in time it helped establish the doctrine that true statements about public officials could not be prosecuted as libel. Newspapers were thus eventually free to print responsible criticisms of powerful officials, though full freedom of the press was unknown during the pre-revolutionary era. American colonists may have been backward in natural or physical science, but they were making noteworthy contributions to political science. The 13 colonial governments took a variety of forms. By 1775, 8 of the colonies had royal governors, who were appointed by the king. 3, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, were under proprietors who themselves chose the governors. And 2, Connecticut and Rhode Island, elected their own governors under self-governing charters. Practically every colony utilized a two-house legislative body. The upper house, or council, was normally appointed by the crown in the royal colonies, and by the proprietor in the proprietary colonies. It was chosen by the voters in the self-governing colonies. The lower house, as the popular branch, was elected by the people, or rather by those who owned enough property to qualify as voters. In several of the colonies, the backcountry elements were seriously underrepresented, and they hated the ruling colonial clique, perhaps more than they did kingly authority. Legislatures, in which the people enjoyed direct representation, voted such taxes as they chose for the necessary expenses of colonial government. Self-taxation through representation was a precious privilege that Americans had come to cherish above most others. Governors appointed by the king were generally able men, sometimes outstanding figures. Some, unfortunately, were incompetent or corrupt, broken-down politicians badly in need of jobs. The worst of the group was probably impoverished Lord Cornbury, first cousin of Queen Anne, who was made governor of New York and New Jersey in 1702. He proved to be a drunkard, a spendthrift, a grafter, an embezzler, a religious bigot, and a vain fool who was accused, probably inaccurately, of dressing like a woman. Even the best appointees had trouble with the colonial legislatures, basically because the royal governor embodied a bothersome transatlantic authority some 3,000 miles away. The colonial assemblies found various ways to assert their authority and independence. Some of them employed the trick of withholding the governor's salary unless he yielded to their wishes. He was normally in need of money. Otherwise, he would not have come to this godforsaken country. So the power of the purse usually forced him to terms. But one governor of North Carolina died with his salary 11 years in arrears. The London government, in leaving the colonial governor to the tender mercies of the legislature, was guilty of poor administration. In the interest of simple efficiency, the British authorities should have arranged to pay him from independent sources. As events turned out, control over the purse by the colonial legislatures led to prolonged bickering, which proved to be one of the persistent irritants that generated a spirit of revolt. Administration at the local level was also varied. County government remained the rule in the plantation South. Town meeting government predominated in New England, and a modification of the two developed in the middle colonies. In the town meeting, with its open discussions and open voting, direct democracy functioned at its best. In this unrivaled cradle of self-government, Americans learned to cherish their privileges and exercise their duties as citizens of the New World Commonwealths. Yet the ballot was by no means a birthright. Religious or property qualifications for voting, with even stiffer qualifications for office holding, existed in all the colonies in 1775. The privileged upper classes, fearful of democratic excesses, were unwilling to grant the ballot to every biped of the forest. Perhaps half of the adult white males were thus disfranchised, but because of the ease of acquiring land and thus satisfying the property requirements, the right to vote was not beyond the reach of most industrious and enterprising colonists. Yet, somewhat surprisingly, eligible voters often did not exercise this precious privilege. They frequently acquiesced in the leadership of their betters who ran colonial affairs, though always reserving the right to vote misbehaving rascals out of office. By 1775, America was not yet a true democracy, socially, economically, or politically. But it was far more democratic than England and the European continent. Colonial institutions were given freer rein to the democratic ideals of tolerance, educational advantages, equality of economic opportunity, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, and representative government. And these democratic seeds, planted in rich soil, were to bring forth a lush harvest in future years. Everyday life in the colonies may now seem glamorous, especially as reflected in antique shops, but judged by modern standards, it was drab and tedious. For most people, the labor was heavy and constant, from can see to can't see. Food was plentiful, though the diet could be coarse and monotonous. Americans probably ate more bountifully, especially of meat, than any people in the Old World. Lazy or sickly was the person whose stomach was empty. Basic comforts now taken for granted were lacking. Churches were not heated at all, except for charcoal foot warmers that the women carried. During the frigid New England winters, the preaching of hellfire may not have seemed altogether unattractive. Drafty homes were poorly heated, chiefly by inefficient fireplaces. There was no running water in the houses, no indoor plumbing, and probably not a single bathtub in all of colonial America. Candles and whale oil lamps provided faint and flickering illumination. Garbage disposal was primitive. Long-snouted hogs customarily ranged the streets to consume refuse, while buzzards, protected by law, flapped greedily over tidbits of waste. Amusement was eagerly pursued where time and custom permitted. The militia assembled periodically for musters, which consisted of several days of drilling, liberally interspersed with merrymaking and flirting. On the frontier, pleasure was often combined with work at house raisings, quilting bees, husking bees, and apple parings. Funerals and weddings everywhere afforded opportunities for social gatherings, which customarily involved the swilling of much strong liquor. Winter sports were common in the North, whereas in the South, card playing, horse racing, cockfighting, and fox hunting were favored pastimes. George Washington, not surprisingly, was a superb rider. In the non-puritanical South, dancing was the rage. Jigs, square dances, the Virginia reel. And the agile Washington could swing his fair partner with the best of them. Other diversions beckoned. Lotteries were universally approved, even by the clergy, and were used to raise money for churches and colleges, including Harvard. Stage plays became popular in the South, but were frowned upon in Quaker and Puritan colonies, and in some places forbidden by law. Many of the New England clergy saw play-acting as time-consuming and immoral. They preferred religious lectures, from which their flocks derived much spiritual satisfaction. Holidays were everywhere celebrated in the American colonies, but Christmas was frowned upon in New England as an offensive reminder of popery. Yuletide is fooltide, was a common Puritan sneer. Thanksgiving Day came to be a truly American festival, for it combined thanks to God with an opportunity for jollification, gorging, and guzzling. By the mid-18th century, Britain's several North American colonies, despite their differences, revealed some striking similarities. All were basically English in language and customs, and Protestant in religion, while the widespread presence of other peoples and faiths compelled every colony to cede at least some degree of ethnic and religious toleration. Compared with contemporary Europe, they all afforded to enterprising individuals unusual opportunities for social mobility. They all possessed some measure of self-government, though by no means complete democracy. Communication and transportation among the colonies were improving. British North America by 1775 looked like a patchwork quilt, each part slightly different, but stitched together by common origins, common ways of life, and common beliefs in toleration, economic development, and above all, self-rule. Fatefully, all the colonies were also separated from the seat of imperial authority by a vast ocean moat some 3,000 miles wide. These simple facts of shared history, culture, and geography set the stage for the colonists' struggle to unite as an independent people.